Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear highlights from the 2017 Great Conversations Luncheon, presented annually by Kathy Simon and the College of St. Mary. The keynote address this year will be given by Elizabeth Berg, author of over 25 books, including Open House, The Dream Lover, Durable Goods, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, and her latest novel, The Story of Arthur Truelove. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 27, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Terry Campbell, Vice President for Alumni and Donor Relations at the College of St. Mary.
This isn't just a regular hall where we're just having a nice lunch and we're going to listen to a wonderful author. This is the College of St. Mary. So one of the things that we like to do is we have a student speaker, and she is fantastic. Her name is Ashley Salem, and she's going to share her story with us today. Ashley grew up in Omaha and graduated from Westside High School, and she'll be graduating from the College of St. Mary in May. So please help me welcome her to the podium.
Thank you, Terry. Glass shattering against the cement floor, shards spewing in every direction, the sharp edges ripping holes into my hopes, dreams, and access out and into the life I wanted. This is what I heard and what it felt like when I received word my senior year of high school. The word that the program that had promised me and several other students full rides to college had all its funding cut. I scrambled to find the words and hold back tears all at once. How could this be? All the work and volunteering, late nights and early mornings I did for this program, not to mention the chaos of my parents divorcing, working full time, and actually going to high school. A first-generation student, devastated with no resources. How could this be? It was all I could muster. I need to introduce you to someone so that this all makes sense. She looks a lot like me, a little girl about yay high. She has a hazelnut complexion, head full of curls, creative yet analytical, trauma-strucken, and a spirit of perseverance like you have never seen. I was that girl. Going through grade school and high school wasn't always easy for me, but I found happiness and joy in writing, helping peers, and seeing people truly happy. I would be the Oprah, my mom says, to all my friends. I would tear apart the information they gave me, download it as data, and spit out algorithms to solve all their problems. I had to learn, though, that all who are there for you are all that you are there for may not always be there for you. A depressing realization to face among all the other stuff I was wrestling with. I was happy most of the time, truly so. I didn't know I had bouts with anxiety and depression. Those words were unknown to me and didn't exist in my reality. It was easy. You get up, do what you have to do, you go to sleep, and you repeat. Having the gift of perspective, I was always able to find an angle to pull me through. I worked. I paid for classes at a community college. Sometimes I could afford to pay for classes, and sometimes I could not. Sometimes I could afford to pay for classes, but not could pay for books, so I had to wait the next semester to attend. I had no help, and I was terrified of loans. I loved my family, and there were times that I helped them as well. I worked. I took classes. I worked, and then I had my son, a beautiful butter brown reflection of my own with one dimple. He gave me the hope to pursue more, and when he was about 3 months, I graduated with my associate's degree. I was so happy and so thankful, but to my dismay, my associate's degree wasn't quite the meal ticket into the tax bracket that I wanted to be in. I had been praying to God to lead and guide me, and boy, did he have my back every time. I found out about College of St. Mary. The slogan here is watch me bloom, but in every capacity I have. Having access to a quality education and the Mother's Living and Learning Center here has been incremental in my development. My teachers are available to go over material I want more clarification on and provide additional literature to assist in my studies. Living among the other mothers have helped me realize just as much as I can be, as well as seeing my son socialize with their children. He calls them his brothers and sisters. I am proud to stand in front of you today as a senior graduating May 21st of 2017. It brings me to tears to think of my progress and the introspective work I have done on my own. I won't cry because I don't cry cute. I cry falling all over the podium. And it's just not pretty, but I am proud. And I'm proud that my parents got remarried to each other. And their work and ethic in their careers and in rebuilding their marriage, it makes me proud to be their daughter. So, on April 27th, 2017, who is Ashley Salem? She's a senior in general studies studying business analytics and strategic communication with a social science emphasis at College of St. Mary. She is passionate about advocacy, analytics, and creativity. She's a single mother to an inquisitive toddler, a Phi Beta Lambda State Award recipient, a member on several local boards and communities, all while working, studying, and promoting visibility and education in her community. As I look in the mirror at who I am today, I see my hazelnut hue, my curly natural hair, my smile, my hard work, my tenacity, and my God. I am thankful, growing and cultivating all that I was called to be. My outlook on life can be simple yet complex. Broad paint strokes, glitter and tea, stationary pen and paper, my soul formulating data as words on pages that dance on lines like ballerinas and b-boys dancing to a beat. Apple juice and tiki masala, unlimited amounts of good toilet paper, peace, love, and all that is good. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley, for sharing your story and all of the wonderful things you've accomplished here at the college and in your life. Wasn't she fantastic? Now, I would like to invite Sister Mary Ann back to the podium to introduce our featured guest.
Thanks, Terry. There's another Terry in the room. Terry Salem, will you stand up? This is Ashley's father. So congratulations to you two. None of us does these things like Ashley has done alone, and you and your wife, her mother, have done a wonderful job.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. We are honored to have Elizabeth Berg, author of Open House, The Dream Lover, Durable Goods, and The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, among other titles, here today, to share her stories with us and to introduce us to her latest novel, The Story of Arthur True Love, which will be out in July. Elizabeth was born in Minnesota and loved books and reading from the time her mother began reading to her and loved writing them since she could hold a pencil in her hand. She submitted her first poem to American Girl magazine, I remember that magazine, at the age of 9 because it was rejected, it took her 25 years before she ever submitted anything again. A sad thing. And now she has over 25 published books, has been named the winner of the 1997 New England Booksellers Award, and received the Abbey Award to name just a few of her honors. Quoting the Boston Globe, quote, Elizabeth Berg's gift as a storyteller lies most profoundly in her ability to find the extraordinary in the ordinary, the remarkable in the everyday. Please help me give a warm welcome to Elizabeth Berg.
I am thrilled to be here today, and I want to thank Kathy Simon for inviting me, Dr. Farr. I had the privilege of speaking with Marianne. It seems like I ought to call you more than that, but I had the privilege of speaking with her because when I was writing the story of Arthur Truelove, there is a character in the book, and I needed some information from Marianne about this school in order to accommodate that character. And she told me things that I could hardly believe in terms of what is offered here for someone who has a child. What, it's so difficult to go to college anyway. And then if you have a small child, I was just amazed that such a school existed. And I wanted to honor it, and it is honored in a small way in this book. Yeah, I really was happy to do that. But thank you, thank you, thank you for inviting me to this most wonderful place. And thank to all of you for coming, too. I really appreciate that, and I'm sure the college does, too. Before I go into the body of this talk, I wanted to tell you a little story about my daughter, Jennifer Berg. When she was in sixth grade, she was in public school, and I noticed that she was falling behind. It seemed to me significantly falling behind. And I went to her school to talk to her teachers, and they said, "Now she's fine." I knew she wasn't fine. And so I took her to see someone who evaluated her. And he told me at the conclusion of his evaluation, she's not got a high IQ. She's going to struggle to get even C's, so don't expect much. And when we went out into the parking lot, my then husband and I, he said, and he meant it as a joke, he didn't mean it to be cruel, but he said, "Oh, she's not difficult, she's just dumb." And it cut me to the quick, and I thought, you know what? I don't think this is true. Jenny had a really interesting personality. She kind of went her own way. And she liked all those complex children's books instead of the easy ones about cute little animals that I preferred to read. But she liked the complex ones. She kept a stack, a high stack of Vogue magazines in her closet. From the time when she was maybe 10 or 11, we used to have big fights about it, because I'd say, "Get those magazines out of your closet. There's no room for your shoes." And she'd say, "I want those magazines." And I would say, "Why do you want those magazines?" And she would say, "Because I want them." So I put Jenny in a girls' school. Jenny went on to go to the University of Chicago, where she graduated on the dean's list. You know why? Because of that girls' school. And I would like to take some credit, but I cannot. It was that girls' school that changed her life. So obviously, I have a personal reason for believing in what these schools do. And I've seen the evidence. Jenny's a writer now. And guess who she just started writing for? Yes! Vogue magazine! All right. So I want to give you a little outline of what I'm going to talk about so that if you start getting restless, you'll know, oh, yeah, she said that part, so we're almost at the end. I want to give you a little recipe for what I believe makes a writer. I want to tell you about my journey to becoming a writer and how nursing school, of all things, was my school of writing. I want to give you a little bit of news about the most recent books. And at the end, this is how you'll know it's at the end. I want to share an essay that's very special to me. I never published it. I don't want to publish it. I've had offers to publish it. I don't want to. I save it to read on special occasions such as this. Kathy Simon has heard this essay before, and I can't tell you how I stayed up nights thinking, but she's heard it before. But I'm comforted to learn that her memory is about as good as mine, so no problem. So what makes a writer? What are the characteristics that writers share? From my point of view, they are these. For one thing, you have to be a loner, at least a bit of a loner, because so much of your work is spent alone. I can give you an example of how I knew I was a loner and how my mom knew. Because when I was growing up, living in Germany, I'm an army brat, so we moved every 10 minutes, and we were living in Germany, and I guess I was about 5 years old, and my mother thought it would be good for me to have a playmate. Why wouldn't she think so? And so she kind of imported another American girl to come over, not the doll, a person, to come over and play with me. So the girl showed up in my playroom, and I looked at her, and I said, go home. And my mother was horrified, and rightly so. But for me, I mean, I was busy down there. I was imagining things. I was looking at my kaleidoscope and my ViewMaster, and I was perfectly content. I had no need to you know, what am I going to do? Say, so I'm looking at this ViewMaster. I'd have to explain everything. No, I didn't want anything to do. So the other characteristic is that of a certain sensitivity. You have to be sensitive in order to feel things, because you have to feel them in order to describe them. My mother's nickname for me, Sarah Bernhardt. Okay, enough said. You also have to have the habit of noticing all the time. You don't work just when you're sitting at your computer typing out words on your novel or short story or essay or whatever it is that you're writing. You're working all the time, which means that you bring back to the nest, so to speak, the interesting details of life that you see around you all the time. It's also what makes you a dismal dining partner, because you're watching everyone else and not the person with whom you are having dinner. I regret to say, don't marry a writer is my advice to you. Okay. The most important thing, though, about a writer is a need to get what's in here out there. And you just have to do it. It's how you come to understand the world. It's how you translate all the things that you feel and experience around you into some kind of coherent form. Whether you choose to publish or not, or to try to get published, is up to you. But if you don't feel that need to get what's in here out there, then to my mind, you're not really a writer. And for those of you who have things in your drawers that you have written, getting this out there, no one, and you want to be published, not everybody does, but if you want to be published, nobody's going to come to your door and say, I'm here for your manuscript. So you have to take the terrible chance of rejection. And you heard Sister Marianne tell you, when I was 9 years old, I was rejected. And I was just so upset. I went up to my bedroom and flung myself across the bed and wept and wept. And then, as you heard, didn't try to publish for 20-something years. Don't do that if you want to be a writer. So what I did was I went to college at the University of Minnesota as an English major, and then I switched to humanities, and then I dropped out because it was the 60s, and that's what you did. And I became a receptionist. I worked at a hotel. That was my first job. I worked at the Radisson Hotel as an information clerk, even though I had no information about anything. That's what I was the information clerk. And then I got a job as a receptionist at a law firm where every day I said, Chestnut, Jones, Brooks, Kennedy, and Burkhardt, 10,000 times. I was a girl singer in a rock band. I was an actress in an improvisational theater company called the Brave New Workshop. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And finally, it came to me in a kind of important moment that I wanted to be a nurse. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to help people feel better. I wanted to have my hands on people who really needed help. So I went to nursing school, which, as I alluded to earlier, was my school of writing, and it truly was. Here's why. The first thing we were taught in nursing school was to have what was called unconditional positive regard toward every patient for whom we cared. What that meant was that you checked your judgment at the door when you went into a patient's room, and you tried with all your head and all your heart to see that person as a fully formed individual with reasons for being the way they were, positive or negative. And when you do that, you gain a great deal of insight into character and motivation and for rationale. That's invaluable for not only a nurse, but for a writer. The other thing we were taught was, I don't know if they teach this here in the School of Nursing, but when we looked at patients in order to evaluate them, we were meant to take what was called the cephalocaudal approach, which means head to toe. So you don't just walk in and look at someone's face or their monitor. Do you ever have this happen? You're in the hospital and the person comes in and looks at the monitor and says, "How are you?" And you're over there. So the cephalocaudal approach meant that you really took in a person head to toe because you see things that can help you understand if there's a problem going on. Similarly, when you're a writer, if you look only at the circumscribed oval of a person's face, you get a lot of information, but you can get more if you keep on going. You have to be a little careful because if you inspect someone head to toe, they can get nervous about that. So my recommendation is the next time you're at the airport with yet another delayed flight, just sit in a chair and sort of quietly look at people. What are their feet doing? What are their knees doing? What are their hands doing? And there's just a wealth of information about people that you can see. That was very useful for me to learn. Finally, the art of listening. The very first time we saw patients, we did nothing but sit at the bedside and listen. And the only words we spoke were those meant to evoke more words from the patient. That's a really hard thing to do because when you're having conversation, you're usually preparing what you're going to say next in the back of your mind. No matter how compelling what they're saying, you want in on it too. So you're getting ready to say, "Yeah, well, I..." So you couldn't do that. And you just had to listen to what they were saying. But that was very valuable training for a writer as well. So I worked as a nurse for 10 years, and I really loved it. I think nurses and teachers will someday get the kind of pay grade that they deserve and the recognition they deserve. And I hope it happens in my lifetime. But I had two young daughters, and I wanted to stay home with them. So I was trying to think of what I could do. We really needed the income. What can I do and make money but be home with my daughters? And I didn't think I'd be very good at Tupperware parties, even though I love Tupperware. I do. I love Tupperware. I didn't think I could do any kind of sales because I'm just too shy. There was a Bob Newhart show used to have one of that guy's patients. Bob Newhart was a psychologist, and one of his patients was a salesperson. And his idea of selling things was to go and stand on a porch, not ring the bell, just stand there in case they open the door. So that's how I would have been. So I was kind of casting about for what I could do. And I recalled those days. When I was 9 years old, the reason I wrote that poem, which was promptly rejected as it should have been because it was a terrible poem even for a kid, but I wanted to do it because I wanted to win the money, which I thought would be a lot of money, because I wanted to buy my dad a Cadillac. My dad was a lifer in the Army and one of the fiercest personalities you would ever have met. I was afraid of him practically all my life, but I revered him. And he was the person I wanted most to please. So he had a piggy bank on his dresser, and it was a big fat pig. And across the belly of the pig was a banner that said, "For my Cadillac." That was not in my dad's budget, I can assure you. He was never going to get a Cadillac. But he put his quarters or his dollar bills or whatever it was in the piggy bank. So I told my dad when I was 9 years old, standing in the kitchen of Fort Hood, Texas, with my father leaning against the washing machine, "I am going to be famous someday, and I'm going to buy you a red Cadillac." And he said, "Yeah." And he laughed at me. And I, if you'll remember the Sarah Bernhardt thing, I said, I am, I'm going to be famous someday, and I'm going to buy you a Cadillac. And he said, "Okay." And I believed that he believed in me in that moment, and it meant everything. But then I went to nursing school, so anyway. I'll tell you more about that later. So when I decided I wanted to be a writer, I thought about the friends and the teachers especially who had told me, "You should be a writer." So I thought, well, maybe I'll be a writer. And I knew nothing about the craft, which was probably good, because if I had taken classes or if I'd tried to find out about it, I think I would have been discouraged. I think I would have thought, this is too hard. Nobody ever gets published. I'm not going to do it. But being naive, I just entered an essay contest and won it, and then began writing. That was for Parents Magazine. And I began writing regularly for Parents Magazine, then for virtually every woman's magazine on the market, the New York Times. I didn't think I would ever write fiction. But suddenly, after a number of years, I became interested in fiction. So I began writing short stories and getting those published. Never thought I'd write a novel. One day I was writing an essay about what it felt like to move around all the time, what it felt like to be the new girl all the time. And there was something bigger in there than the essay form allowed. I knew that there was something bigger in here. And I thought it might be a novel. And indeed it was. And that was Durable Goods, which was my first novel. Like many authors' first books, that book was highly autobiographical. I sent about 90 pages to my agent. It wasn't done yet, but I sent it to her. And she called telling me that she loved it and she wanted to send it to two publishers. And I thought, this is great. And she sent it to the publishers on a Friday, and on Monday they both called wanting to buy it. And I was beside myself. I was so happy I didn't get dressed all day because... And then I thought, uh-oh, there is a lot of autobiographical stuff in here, specifically about what it's like to grow up terrified of your father and why. So I called my mom, who was a great reader. All my life she had big stacks of books on her nightstand every night. She'd eat a candy bar while she read a book. It was all I wanted to do when I grew up. Anyway, I called my mom and I said, "Listen, this is really good news. I have the opportunity to have a book published, but the problem is there's a lot of sort of personal stuff in here, and it is fictionalized, and there's an overarching theme that is fiction, but I don't want to hurt Dad. So I don't know what to do. And there's a lot about being afraid of your father in there." She said, "Well, send me the manuscript and I'll read it and I'll tell you what I think." So I sent her the manuscript. She hid it under her bed and she read it and she called me. She said, "You know, I think if you don't publish this, you'd hurt your father more than if you did." So I said, "Oh, good." So I published it, and I'll tell you, it was a little awkward for a while with my dad after he read it. He finished it sitting in the little den where he and my mom watched TV, and he looked up at her and he said, "Was I this bad?" And she said, "You were pretty bad." And what it did is not hurt him so that it ruined our relationship, which we didn't have anyway. Instead, it forged a relationship between my dad and me. It was what allowed us to become really close. It was what made him my guy. It really did. It made us able to talk about things. It made me able to understand his side and he mine. So it was a gift in so many ways. I wrote for magazines for 10 years, then I started writing novels, and I was writing a novel every year, and people would say, oh, so you try to write a novel every year, and it used to really irritate me because, no, that's not what I was doing. I was just writing. It just happened that I had a novel a year, but I didn't want to be one of those, you know, the French call them ink pissers. I hope I can say that. Too late if I can't say it, but anyway. I didn't want to be like that. I wanted to write literary fiction that was, you know, that was the best I could do, and that if it came out every year, it didn't mean anything about the quality. So I now have, honestly, I don't know the number. I think it's 27 or 28 books, and I had the first one published when I was 44. So all of you out there who are thinking you have to start when you're, you know, Ashley's age. Not true. Not true. Ashley, by the way, wins the Smile of the Year award. I just want to say you have the most beautiful smile. So being a writer has been wonderful for so many reasons. And there have been some highlights. Selling that first novel was one of my best days. The day that Oprah called, although it wasn't Oprah, it was her team who called me to say that my book had been chosen for their book club was a very big day. I did not believe them, as most of the authors who are chosen for the book club don't. And I had been living in Natick, Massachusetts, thinking about moving to Chicago. And I was out in my garden in my pajamas, which, as you know now, is my favorite way of dressing. Hugh Hefner and I should get married. But I was standing in the garden, and I said out loud about moving to Chicago, I need a sign. And the phone rang, and it was Chicago calling. So that was a really wonderful moment. And you know, when she did her book club, which I really wish she still did, but you couldn't tell anybody. So this big thing has happened, right? And I said, well, can I just tell one person? And they said, yeah, you can tell one person. So I told five very discreet people, and that was a peak moment. But you know what the best moment was, really the very best moment of my publishing life? After Oprah, I knew I was going to get a big paycheck, and I called my dad, and I said, "Hey, Dad, do you still like Cadillacs?" And my dad said, "You know, I kind of like Lincolns now." I said, "Well, I just got some really good news, and I'm going to buy you a Lincoln." And he said, "No, you're not." And I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "No, you're not." And I said, "Yes, I am." This went on for about half an hour. And then finally I said to him, "Well, you know, you can pick out a car, or I'm going to pick one out for you." And we hung up. And he called me the next day, and he said, "Were you serious about that?" And I said, "Yes, I was." And he said, "Well, I was down at the Cadillac showroom." And he bought the longest, reddest Cadillac you ever saw, with the white roof and the white tires and all that. My mom, who was 5'1 and a half, looked like a dot next to that car. But he loved that car so much. He, on the way home from picking it up, he stopped at the hospital where his brother was a patient and made him get up and get in a wheelchair and come out in the parking lot and see that car. Then he drove it home, and he parked it in his teeny tiny garage, and he ever so carefully closed the door, even though it was a beautiful summer day, and he knocked his golf clubs into the car and scratched it, which he had immediately fixed. But, oh, my, there was not a bit of dirt inside or outside that car. He had his blankets carefully folded. He had his Perry Como tapes and his dinosaur tape. It was a pleasure to ride in that car. After he got macular degeneration, he could no longer drive, and it broke his heart. And he would go, my mom said, he goes out and talks to the car. And he told me one time when I came home to visit, I have an idea. I'll drive, but your mom will ride shotgun and look out for stuff. I said, Dad, please don't do that. And when it became clear that he was not long for the world, he was kind of worried about what was going to happen to the car. And I said, well, do you want to be buried in it? And he said, yeah. So I tried, but it turns out not so easy. So the car went to my sister, and the car is now living in Minnesota, where it now has about 100 miles on it. So, you know, it's been around for many years, but they didn't drive it that much. So that was my very best moment in publishing. It has come to the time in my life when I want to focus on joy. I think that we've been living in extremely difficult times. I don't care what your political convictions are, but we are living in extremely difficult and unctuous, just horrible times where a sense of civility seems to have been lost. And I, after writing the Dream Lover, which, as you heard, is about George Sand, the publisher was very happy with that book, and they wanted me to write another one like that. And I was all too happy to oblige, because I kind of liked the book after I wrote it, which was not a picnic. But I was writing about Carson McCullers. Those of you who know about Carson McCullers know that her life was not particularly happy. For example, she looks out the window one day and her husband Reeves has hung himself from the pear tree, and she goes out and cuts him down and says, "Reeves, don't hang yourself in my favorite tree." And this was not his only suicide attempt. I mean, there's a lot of darkness in her life. She had serious illness all her life. I'm writing about this and writing about it. And you know, when you write a book, you live it. It's with you all the time, whether you're working on it or not. And I was getting really depressed, so I switched to something else. I had the image in my head for a long time of an old guy who goes to a cemetery with a little fold-up chair and sits at his wife's grave and talks to her. This was years ago. And I wrote a few pages and I put it away because for some reason it wasn't time. And if there's anything I've learned about writing, it's to trust yourself. So I put it away. But after I decided no on Carson McCullers, I pulled out this book again. When I was in the South touring one time, I met a bus driver. I like to ride buses. And I met a bus driver named True Love Moses. And I said, "Is that your real name?" And he said, "Yeah, that's my real name." And I said, "Can I borrow it? If I write something, can I use your name?" He said, "Of course." So I wrote a book that was called True Love Moses. And then because of various reasons, the title got changed to The Story of Arthur True Love. True Love is a nickname that's given to this character. I've said for years that Durable Goods is my favorite novel. It's a close second now to this one, which brought me so much joy in the writing and the reading, and I can hardly wait for it to come out. It was going to come out in the spring. Nope, got moved back to July, the end of July. I thought, oh, okay. Then I got a call from my agent the other day. She said, "Guess what? This is such good news. They're moving your book to November." And I said, "What?" And then I had a little hissy fit. And she said, "I think you're not hearing me. This is good news because they're making it the big book for the fall." And I said, "But what about all the people who already ordered it?" If anyone in this room has already ordered it, I apologize. But it's coming out at the end of November now. The other more recent book is a collection of Facebook posts that I did because so many people who come to Facebook, and by the way, I was dragged to Facebook kicking and screaming. I really didn't want to do it, but I've come to sort of like it. It's like a little family, the people who come there. But I want to share with you a very brief section from both books so that you'll have a sense of what they're like and also of what it is I'm doing now, if you're interested. This section comes after Arthur is visiting with a neighbor to whom a tragedy has occurred. Arthur is 85 years old. His neighbor is 83. And they're sitting out on Lucille's porch in the rocking chairs. They begin to rock slowly, For a long time, neither she nor Arthur speaks. Their chairs do the talking for them. Then Lucille says, "It's so embarrassing to be useless." "Why, you're not useless," Arthur says. "Yes, I am." "You're just going through a hard time." "Yes, I am. But also, I am useless. I do nothing. I realized this was happening some time ago, everything falling off, but I made do. I had church. I read books in the paper. I had my garden. But all the lights are off now, and I don't really want to live anymore. What's left for me now? I am useless, and so are you." Arthur straightens in his chair, indignant. "I'm not useless." "You are, too. All you do is go and visit your wife at the graveyard every single day. That's all you do." "Well, first of all, I don't think it's useless to visit Nola. It is my great pleasure and honor to go to the resting place of the finest woman I ever knew and think about the boundless glory of my life with her." "Okay, I'm sorry I said that. I know how you feel about Nola. I know how much it means to you to go and visit her." "No, you don't," Arthur says. "Nobody knows how much it means to me, except maybe her. And apart from that, I am not useless." "But what do? You don't even go to church. You take care of your roses, and that's it." Arthur rocks for a while. Lucille's chair has gone still. But Arthur rocks for a while. "Let me ask you something," he says finally. "What? Did you ever hear anyone say they wanted to be a writer?" "Yes, I've heard lots of people say that." "Everybody wants to be a writer," Arthur says. "Seems like." He stops his rocking to look over at her. "But what we need are readers, right? Where would writers be without readers? Who are they going to write for? And actors, who are they without an audience? Actors, painters, dancers, comedians, even just ordinary people doing ordinary things. What are they without an audience of some sort? See, that's what I do. I am the audience. I am the witness. I am the great appreciator. That's what I do, and that's all I want to do. I worked for a lot of years. I did a lot of things for a lot of years. Now, well, here I am in the rocking chair. And I don't mind it, Lucille. I don't feel useless. I feel lucky." So that's it. Oh, thank you. I want to read you one out of Make Someone Happy, which I'm glad to say that they have out there if you want one. How many of you love to have dinner parties? Okay, not so many, that's what I thought. You're my people. This is called dinner party. I had a dinner party the other night and was a nervous wreck beforehand, even though I had decided to make food I was completely comfortable with. Food is like a horse. If it senses you're nervous, it will misbehave. "It's going to be retro night," I had gaily told my guests, and so I made butternut squash soup, little individual barbecue lemon meatloaves, mashed potatoes, green beans, and an apple pie. But when I checked on the baking pie, I saw the top crust separating from the bottom and juice running out all over the place. I thought, "What the?" And then realized I'd forgotten to put in the flour as a thickener. I called my friend Phyllis, whom I'd already called in a panic about how much cheese to buy for appetizers and how long to wait to serve dinner after the guests arrive. And why do people have dinner parties anyway when it makes you such a nervous wreck? And she answered by saying, "Now what?" I told her that I'd screwed up the pie and that also I didn't have a big enough tablecloth, and so had covered the table with a bunch of On Point vintage tablecloths. "That sounds great," she said. "Really?" I said. And she said, "Yeah. Can you come over?" I said, in my little voice that I use when I'm feeling sorry for myself. I wish I could, she said in her soothing, motherly voice that she uses when she wants to sound soothing and motherly. I said I'd been going to make another pie, but I didn't want to. And so I decided I would just admit to my guests that I'd made a mistake and we'd have to eat the pie with spoons. Or, I said, I would tell them it was a fancy French version of an apple pie meant to be very, very juicy and eaten with spoons. Apple pie de plou plou jus Napoleon. Oh, don't lie, Phyllis said. They might know you're lying. Oh, they'll definitely know I'm lying, I said. But see, that will be part of the entertainment portion of the evening. But maybe when I serve the pie, I'll say, you know, there's a tradition in quilting where you always leave a mistake in the quilt because life isn't perfect, but it's still good. And there's a mistake in this pie, but I'm going to serve it anyway because you are all my friends and I feel safe with you. Yeah, Phyllis said. And again, I asked her to come over. And again, she said, no, she does live in California after all. And then we hung up. Well, when it was time to serve the pie, I said my little speech, and then guess what? The pie was fine. I don't know how that happened. And I choose to think it was a miracle. Thank you. I've been talking long enough, and so I'm actually not going to read an essay, but I can tell you that the heart of this essay is about books and reading and what it offers us and how it's more important than ever that we read. Because when we read, we become reacquainted with actual time. And we take time and we reflect and we contemplate. And everything inside sort of slows down and expands and becomes willing to listen and learn and change. And it's essential now more than ever. And it's fun. I'm reading a book right now by I forgot the author, Edgar and Lucy it's called. Fantastic, big fat one. And honestly, I can hardly wait to go to bed so I can read. So sometimes I go to bed at 6 o'clock, don't tell anybody. Okay, it has been my absolute privilege and pleasure to speak to all of you. I am thrilled to have been invited here. I am thrilled to lend whatever support I can to an institution that does so much for so many, including Ashley, that makes people feel like, well, here, I got a little thing written down here I'm going to read you. So important. Here's what I want to say to you. I wish you the best. I wish you everything. Perhaps most of all, the belief that you are deserving of everything. I think that that's what this school does. And boy, if I had gone to this school, I would have written a lot earlier than I did. Thank you very much.
We really don't invite authors here to give a plug for College of St. Mary, but it's wonderful that you've done that, Elizabeth. We do have a few minutes. We usually try to end by 1:30, and I promise you I'm a stickler for time, so we will. So we have just a few minutes. Does anyone have any questions? We have, oh, there's hands here. I think we have some microphones. Lizzie has one, and I'm going to give it just because this is a microphone close to Sherry.
Did you have any siblings?
Yes. Yes, I have a I guess if we're going to do Q&A, I'll come back up here. And thank you for allowing that. Yes, I have a sister who's 5 years older, and I have a brother who's 5 years younger. He lives in Hawaii, and he keeps saying, why don't you come here? And I don't want to tell him the truth, which is I get sort of bored over there because I'm not a beach person. You know? So I just say, I'm coming.
All right, we've got two back here. I'll start here.
Okay.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for coming. I'm here with 12 women who are part of four different book groups, and we all read Elizabeth Berg over the past 2 months. So thank you for giving us good reading. I loved the conversation with Nancy Horan that's in the back of this, where the visual that I got was, you write the book, and then I think you probably did rock, paper, scissors. I want to know, do you feel like you won when you got to write this?
She wouldn't do it. I am not known for historical fiction. I am known for writing novels about women sitting in their curlers in the kitchen bitching about their husbands. And so when I read about George Sand, I saw that a novel needed to be written about her. She was utterly fascinating. Who's the person to do it? Nancy used to be in my writer's group. She was in my writer's group when she wrote Loving Frank. And I called her and I said, you have to write about George Sand. And she said, I'm exhausted. I'm not writing about anybody. You write about her. And I said, I can't write about her. She said, of course you can. It'll be fabulous. That's how the conversation went. So then she came to visit me when I was writing it, actually. And I was a little terrified to show her pages because, you know, Loving Frank is terrific. And so she went and read the pages. I had quite a few at that time while I chewed off my non-existent fingernails. And then she came out and she said, well, I don't know how you did it, but you did it. So that was another high moment in publishing. But seriously, it was because she wouldn't write it that I did. Yeah.
All right, we've got another one right here.
Okay, in your book, Home Safe, your main character, Helen, is a writer, and she's thinking about quitting, and she says, maybe it's not such a bad time to come to the end of her career as a writer. She doesn't see how the growing trend of screens taking precedence over pages can be overcome. Books aren't loud enough. They're not showy enough. They don't move quickly enough. Indeed, they don't move at all. They require stillness, reflection, imagination, and the things are out of step with the times. Thank heaven for the popularity of book clubs. Sometimes Helen thinks they're the main reason publishers and authors are still in business. Would you comment on that a little bit? Is that just Helen talking, or is that a lot of your feelings too?
You know, in all my books, there's a lot of my feelings. I do think it's hard for books to keep up with the showy, flashy, speedy world we live in. I do now, since I've written that book, though, see a trend back toward reading, because I think people need that kind of thing for the reasons I've already described. And publishers do love those book clubs, don't they? I mean, do they send you boxes of candy and stuff? I mean, they do love. And book clubs, you know, they're great. I will say that I don't think everybody in every book club reads every book every time. I will say that. But I think they're wonderful. I truly do. I should be in a book club, but I'm not. But maybe I will join one when I get home. But to answer your question, I really can't say much beyond that. That I think people are coming back to books. And thank you very much for reading my books in your club. How did I hear about the College of St. Mary and how did it end up in my recent book? Well, I heard about it because of Kathy Simon. And I met Kathy when I was doing a talk for the Northern Trust, and then I heard from her about this place. And I was writing a character. She's a high school girl who's bullied. And let's see. Well, I'm just going to tell you she gets pregnant. I didn't want to tell you that because it's a plot point, you know. Don't tell anyone else. But she gets pregnant, and she has a horrible home environment. Horrible home environment. And I was thinking, what does someone like that do? And I'd heard about this place, and then when I talked to Marianne, and it sounded impossible. What's provided here. So what's in the book is there's a lot of other stuff you don't know, but now you're going to know. Now you're going to know that she ends up going to a school. It's an art school, but it's like this one. And she is describing in the pages, there's four bedrooms. You know, I get my own room. My baby gets his or her, because she's still pregnant, own room. So I won't say that it's half the book, but there's a good mention. There's a good mention of this kind of school in there.
I want to say thank you. I have enjoyed your books, and I love reading. But I have a statement, and I just listened to McCullough, you know, and he said an interesting statement. There are still more public libraries in the United States than there are Starbucks. So there's hope.
Isn't he wonderful? You know what I really love about David McCullough? Many things, but primary among them is this. Every time he goes out and talks, he mentions his wife, how he adores her. What a guy.
Okay. Let's say thank you one more time to Elizabeth.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard highlights from the 2017 Great Conversations Luncheon, presented annually by Kathy Simon and the College of St. Mary. The keynote address this year was given by Elizabeth Berg, author of over 25 books, including Open House, The Dream Lover, Durable Goods, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, and her latest novel, The Story of Arthur Truelove. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 27, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Brittany Long, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.